Good evening. An echo of Watergate testifies on collusion, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice in the White House. Hearings are planned to increase funding for 9/11 victims' funds and a bill in Albany to legalize sex workers. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Monday, June 10th, 2019. And a helicopter crashed on the roof of a rain-shrouded Midtown Manhattan skyscraper Monday, killing the pilot and briefly triggering memories of 9/11, though it appeared to be an accident. The crash near Times Square and Trump Tower took the 750-foot AXA Equitable building, sparked a fire, and forced office workers to flee on elevators and downstairs. That's according to witnesses and officials. The pilot was believed to be the only one aboard, and there were no other reports of injuries. It was not immediately clear what caused the crash or why the Augusta A109E was flying in a driving downpour with low cloud cover and in the tightly controlled airspace of Midtown Manhattan. A flight restriction in effect since President Donald Trump took office bans aircraft from flying below 3,000 feet within a one-mile radius of Trump Tower, which is less than a half a mile from the crash site. The helicopter went down within 11 minutes after taking off from a heliport along the East River, a little more than a mile away. Police Commissioner James O'Neill said it may have been returning to its home airport in Linden, New Jersey. The 19-year-old helicopter was linked to a real estate company founded by Italian-born investor Danielle Bodini, according to Federal Aviation Administration records. The company referred an inquiry to a lawyer. A message was left with the attorney seeking comment. Pedro Rodriguez, a pastry line cook at Lee Bernardine, a well-known restaurant in the building, said workers got an announcement telling everyone to exit, and he later heard from people around him that there was a fire on the roof. The evacuation was not chaotic, Rodriguez said, but he was rattled because he immediately thought of the September 11th attacks. The crash happened shortly before 2 p.m. when clouds obscured the roof of the building. Rescue workers swarmed into the scene a few blocks from Rockefeller Center. If you're a New Yorker, you may have a level of PTSD right from 9/11, and I remember that morning all too well. So as soon as you hear an aircraft hit a building, I think my mind goes where every New Yorker's mind goes. That was according to Governor Andrew Cuomo. Videos posted by onlookers showed emergency vehicles in the streets, but no obvious signs of damage to the skyscraper. The fire department later tweeted a photo of the helicopter's wreckage and showed piles of burning debris on the roof. And the star witness of Watergate took a turn as a star witness for House Democrats' inquiries into President Trump on Monday, and in so doing, he laid out a compelling series of parallels between the two situations. Former White House counsel John Dean acknowledged at the start of Monday's House Judiciary Committee hearing that he wasn't there as a fact witness. Instead, he noted in his opening statement several ways in which he sees the report of former special counsel Robert S. Mueller III's echoing Watergate. The most obvious parallel Dean noted involved himself. It concerns the role of the White House counsel. Just as he was the most significant witness against Richard Nixon, former White House counsel Donald McGahn has emerged as the most significant witness in the Mueller investigation. Dean is hardly the first person to draw these parallels between the Mueller report and Watergate, but he's one of the most authoritative, and his opening statement was a detailed recounting of just how much the situation is like deja vu for him.
The last time I appeared before your committee was July 11, 1974, during the impeachment inquiry of Richard Nixon. Clearly, I'm not here today as a fact witness. I accepted the invitation to come here today because I hope I can give a little historical perspective on the Mueller report. In many ways, the Mueller report is to President Trump what the so-called Watergate roadmap, officially titled the Grand Jury Report and Recommendation Concerning Transmission of Evidence to the House of Representatives, was to President Richard Nixon. Stated a little differently, Special Counsel Mueller has provided this committee with a roadmap. Drawing from my testimony, I'd like to offer a few, actually just one I'm going to focus on, parallels I find with the Mueller report. I've laid out in my prepared statement six examples. Those examples are illustrative rather than exhaustive. But let me turn to the sixth, and anybody who has any question about the prior five, I'm happy to address. The sixth is the Mueller report's effort regarding the influence of witnesses with pardons. As the citation shows, it's spread out throughout the report. Mr. Mueller addresses the question of whether President Trump dangled pardons or offered favorable treatment to Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, and Roger Stone, whose name is actually redacted, but based on educated conjecture, I think that's pretty clear who it is. And the question is whether, in return for their pardons, they agreed to, or the suggestion of a pardon, he was seeking them to keep their silence and how they coordinated with investigators. But also the Mueller report offers a very powerful legal analysis that, notwithstanding the fact that the pardon power is one of the most unrestricted presidential powers, it cannot be used for improper purposes. And I give the cite of that argument. What's interesting is Richard Nixon, who used the pardon in a similar way, recognized that it was improper. For example, in December of 1972, Chuck Colson went in to see the president to get a pardon, a commitment for Howard Hunt, who he had been responsible in bringing into the White House and whose wife had recently died in a crash and felt he couldn't withstand a trial and didn't want to spend the rest of his life in jail, so he was seeking a pardon assurance from Chuck Colson. The president reluctantly agreed to do that. And when Hunt was given the word, the so-called Cuban Americans who were part of the Watergate operation, they also took their cue from Hunt and pled. In my March 21st conversation with Nixon, we got into the subjects of pardons, and he at that point said he very clearly understood to grant pardons, it would be wrong. I cite the actual exchange from that conversation. There's one that I did not cite in here is I learned in a later tape that Ehrlichman had been asked by the president to offer me a pardon, to protect me and hopefully encourage me from not breaking rank. Ehrlichman knew that was wrong, so he didn't offer that pardon. In one of my last conversations with Richard Nixon, he told me in a very peculiar manner, getting up from his desk in the EOB office and going across the office and in a stage whisper, saying to me, John, I made a mistake in talking to Colson about clemency for Hunt, didn't I? And I said, yes, Mr. President, that was probably obstruction of justice. When Haldeman and Ehrlichman were departing, they pled with the White House that they be given pardons. I think because Nixon knew he could only compound his situation at that point, that he refused to even entertain the request. Finally, let me close on the note, and I explain this at some length, that I certainly hope Don McGahn is a key witness before this committee. Because of my testimony, the model code of the ABA today makes very clear in Rule 1.13 that Mr. McGahn represents not Donald Trump, but the office of the president. His client is the office of the president, and I think he owes that office his testimony before this committee. Thank you.
And that was Watergate figure John Dean. In many ways, the Mueller report is to President Trump what the so-called Watergate roadmap was to President Nixon, Dean said. Stated a bit differently, Special Counsel Mueller has provided this committee a roadmap. The question is if that roadmap leads to impeachment. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Meanwhile, the dwindling 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund will be the focus of House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday as first responders continue to fight to replenish the fund. A student at Stuyvesant High School, just a short distance from the towers, is Linda Nordstrom. She says the fund doesn't have enough money to make it another year.
The fund offers compensation for physical health consequences from 9/11 to both responders and survivors, so people from the community. The reason we're having hearings about it is because in the last round of renewals for the Zadroga Act, they extended the health program for 75 years, but they only extended the victim compensation fund for five. So it's about to expire.
What are you going to say tomorrow when you testify? What are you asking for?
To fully fund the fund, because they had to make cuts to the payouts of the fund because they're getting so many more claims than they expected to already. So they don't even have enough money to make it to 2020 when they officially expire. But also we're asking them to extend the fund to the length of time that they extended the health program, so another 70 years.
Why is this necessary?
It's necessary because a lot of the serious illnesses that are resulting from people's exposures on 9/11 are actually starting to emerge right now. So a lot of people are getting sick and are not going to be able to make claims in time to actually qualify for the fund. I was a student at Stuyvesant. Our latency periods have been even a little longer than the rest of the community because we were young when we were exposed. And so we're just starting to see a spike in serious illness rates right now. And we expect that to continue into the future. We expect the illness rates to rise pretty significantly. So if we are not able to make claims with this fund after 2020, most of the younger people that were exposed and much of the community and even a lot of the responders that were exposed will get left out of the fund completely. These illnesses are sort of happening on a rolling basis. A lot of cancers have latency periods of like 20 years, 25 years. And so a lot of them are just starting to come up now.
What kind of illnesses and why these illnesses are associated with the 9/11 attacks, and how many people do you think are actually affected by it? And maybe tell us a little bit about your story as well.
There has been pretty extensive research done on first responders because they started getting ill quite quickly after 9/11. And so all of the illnesses we're talking about are illnesses that the World Trade Center Health Program has certified as linked to 9/11 after research on responder populations. And so anything that is covered by the health program or compensable through the Victims Compensation Fund has been linked by that research. We're talking about illnesses that range from manageable but chronic conditions like asthma or acid reflux or rhinosinusitis, which is actually the most common diagnosis in the program, to cancers that are both incredibly common but being seen in much higher numbers in responder and survivor populations, things like breast cancer and digestive cancers, blood cancers, things like that. And then also there's been an unusual incidence of incredibly rare cancers. We have among our Stuyvesant population, we have people who have gotten sick with incredibly rare bone cancers. We have a male breast cancer survivor. And so we're seeing some unusual cancers as well. And so those are also covered. And as far as illness rates, there hasn't been extensive research or surveying done on this population, unfortunately. So we can really only speak anecdotally. But anecdotally, I'm a 35-year-old who knows five people with lymphoma. One of my closest friends has thyroid cancer. I went to school with people who had melanoma, who've had testicular cancer, who've had a number of other cancers. I haven't even had my 20th high school reunion. I'm still pretty young. And so there is a sort of growing sense of panic that not only do all of us seem to know many more cancer survivors than anybody else our age, and this is true of a lot of the other local schools, so students from BMCC and Pace University and other schools that were in the area are seeing a similar trend. We also are seeing the number grow pretty significantly, and we're starting to see more serious illnesses as part of that, those cancer numbers. I just had a classmate who a couple of months ago passed away of a gastric cancer that is considered linked to 9/11 and was not found in time to be treatable. We're just sort of on the cusp of seeing an explosion of those kinds of illnesses because the latency periods are about to come up.
What causes this? Where do these effects, where do these cancers and these diseases come from?
They did ultimately do some studies in the dust that was in the air and found at Ground Zero, and it contained a lot of known carcinogens, things like benzene and, you know, chemicals that we already know are carcinogens. A lot of those chemicals were found in the autopsy of James Zadroga, who's the person who the bill is named for. He was the first person whose death was directly linked to his exposures on 9/11. We also know, because Stuyvesant High School went back to school in Lower Manhattan on October 9th. We went back less than a month later. The Parents Association did some kind of cursory research into the air right around Stuyvesant because we were located right next to the barge that they brought all of the debris from the site to. So they were dumping debris next to our school all day while we were there. And there they found, you know, elevated levels of lead, elevated levels of fiberglass, like things like that that we know are dangerous, obviously, especially to the health of children.
What's the political climate around this?
On the House side, we're pretty optimistic. It has 300 co-sponsors. It has, I think, 80 Republican co-sponsors. So a lot of the initial concerns that got voiced were about cost, but I think a lot of them came around to realize that cost issues sort of compared to the health and safety of people who the government actually misled about the air quality downtown in the early days of the cleanup are not really fair calculations to make.
Has President Trump made any statements?
I don't believe he has. Not to my knowledge, at least.
Back in World War II, we sucked it up. Why are you people having to get paid for being veterans of a war that nobody else gets paid for in the past?
This was not your typical attack. And the reason that people are sick is not just the attack. The reason people are sick is because the federal government told us the air was safe to breathe when they knew it wasn't a few days after the attack. So most of the illnesses are actually linked to being caught in the dust cloud. A lot of the illnesses are also linked to people who didn't need to be in Lower Manhattan, going to Lower Manhattan during the cleanup, staying there for months, cleaning up their own homes or their own offices. Some people were even lured down there with favorable rent deals without that being disclosed, without the dangerous air quality being disclosed to them. It's not really just an issue of we just happened to be in this horrible attack. It's really an issue of the federal government made a choice to mislead hundreds of thousands of residents of Lower Manhattan, of school children, of office workers, about their safety and their health.
Anything you'd like to add?
Anyone who was a student or lived or worked in Lower Manhattan should find out if they qualify for any of the health services that are available and has a physical health condition that has been certified by the World Trade Center Health Program is able to file for a claim and should before the fund closes.
Linda Nordstrom was a student at Stuyvesant High School on September 11th, 2001. The extension bill has bipartisan support in the House and Senate, and lawmakers are hoping for a vote before July 4th. And New York State would legalize the buying and selling of sex under a proposal introduced in the state legislature Monday that would lift criminal penalties for sex work. The bill isn't expected to get a vote before the Democratic-led Senate and Assembly plan to adjourn for the year next week, but supporters still hailed the announcement of the bill as a critical step forward towards repealing criminal penalties for sex workers and their customers. The bill's sponsors in the Assembly, Manhattan Democrat Richard Gottfried, said outlawing prostitution as only force sex workers into the shadows where they can be exploited, trafficked, and then punished for breaking the law. Nina Lowe is an activist with Vocal, an organization that supports sex workers. She says the bill will not impact enforcement of trafficking laws while helping many non-traditional sex workers.
The bill we are introducing would decriminalize sex work between consenting adults. I say decriminalize because right now we are focused on removing criminal penalties for people who trade sex. That includes both the purchase and sale of sex, while upholding all the laws that we use to hold traffickers accountable, to hold people who exploit minors accountable. And so all the laws around trafficking, rape, sexual assault, battery, sexual harassment, etc. Similar to the conversations on marijuana, gay marriage, there's a lot of cultural change that needs to happen for something like this to pass.
Isn't there a tremendous amount of fear that this would be used as a cover to legalize the exploitation of women and things like that?
It's just not accurate. There are about two dozen kind of prostitution-related statutes, and we're not touching any of the statutes that have forced fraud or coercion, that have exploitation, trafficking, like violence. This is strictly about people who sell sex and people who buy sex, and then sex workers working together. It is true that people often trade sex for economic reasons, right? Like people are trading sex for survival. They're trading sex for housing. Trans people have a really hard time not being discriminated against in employment situations, and so they have to rely on the sex trade to survive. And so we understand that like criminalization does not get them out of the sex trade. Resources and housing is what allows them to have more options. So it's not about providing a cover for exploitation because people are already trading sex. It's just a matter of how safe you can make it for people who are already doing it. It's a myth that only women sell sex. the disparity is actually between undocumented people and LGBTQ people and then other people. Young LGBTQ people trade sex at 7 to 8 times the rate of their peers who are cisgender and heterosexual. And then amongst young LGBTQ youth, for example, young gay men actually trade sex at 3 times the rate of cisgender women. So it's not like the sex trade is just men buying sex from women. It's really people in economically vulnerable situations selling sex to survive, and there's really diverse representation of gender identities participating in the industry.
So this would not mean that it would be legal still that somebody could come up to a woman or to anybody on the street, a man or a person of different gender or gender identity, and just request sex on the street. Would this legalize that act?
People get sexually harassed regardless of the state of the criminalization of sex work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, yeah. What laws are on the books don't impact human behavior as much as, one, like what economic choices people have in the case of whether people decide to sell sex, and two, like what just larger culture dictates as acceptable behavior. So we have laws against sexual harassment, but when I walk down the street, I get catcalled every day. I think there's like really a misunderstanding of how laws impact behavior, specifically in this industry.
How would it actually, in your vision, obviously it has a while to work this out, but how do you see it? How does Vocal see this working out in the end?
We think that, one, people who trade sex will have fewer interactions that are violent with both clients and police because the industry will be less underground, and also there's just less policing in their lives. Two, we think that people will be able to report violence and exploitation when it happens. Right now, people are afraid to go to the police because when they go to the police, they get arrested or they get deported in the case of undocumented people. Three, we think that this will reduce the amount of policing, especially in communities of color, transgender nonconforming communities, and then also undocumented communities, not just for people who are selling sex, but also people who are buying sex. And oftentimes you see, whether it's trans women who are misgendered, there's a pretty recent case a couple years ago where people who are soliciting gay sex, like not sex work, it wasn't paid, were also getting criminalized under the patronizing statutes, which are the statutes that criminalize you for buying sex. There's just a lot of policing of sexual behavior in LGBTQ communities that happens because of these statutes, even though it's not sex work. So we think that that would be reduced as well. And then for us, when you have a violent interaction with the police or when you get sent to jail or when you get arrested, that disrupts your entire life. That disrupts if you're currently accessing like drug treatment services, if you have HIV, AIDS, like health care, or if you have gender affirming health care, that like really sets you back. And so we think that it would make people overall more safe as well.
Nina Lowe is an activist with Vocal, an organization that supports sex workers' rights. And a campaign against 4 proposed towers and 2 bridges on the Lower East Side scored a preliminary win on Wednesday as State Supreme Court Judge Arthur Engoron continued an order preventing the towers from moving ahead as they face a trio of lawsuits. Borough President Gail Brewer tweeted that the judge said it's hard to see how these projects can continue without public review. She said she totally agreed. But there are serious divisions among opponents to the mega towers that would soar up to 80 stories above the community below. While some say Councilwoman Margaret Chin wants to extract more from the developers in return for allowing the construction to proceed, others like activist issuance Ning of the Chinatown Workers Group want to end the projects entirely. Ning spoke with WBAI.
The injunction, the temporary halt against the towers last until the judge gives the decision.
Did the judge give any hints about what his decision might be, how he felt about the arguments that were made concerning the towers?
He felt that the towers are too big. The impact is too much. So it doesn't make sense to approve the towers. So I think that's good news for us because that's what the community has been arguing. These kind of out-of-scale towers should not be built.
Will this say that the towers will not be built, or this just says that it goes now, it has to go through the ULURP and through this approval process with public hearings?
The judge might go in either way. You know, he might agree with our argument, which is to say that he should not approve it, or he might go with the council, Mark Chin, a council member, that the tower should go through ULURP. But I think whatever the outcome will be, yes, we will continue to organize and grow our pressure so that the city will eventually back down.
What are the two ways you mentioned? One way is your group's way, which is to stop construction entirely, and then there's the city council, borough president's way, which is go through ULURP. What's the difference between these two?
We talk about politically that Margaret Chin has indicated that she will not stop the towers from going up. So even if you go through the ULURP process, which gives the city council the power to make a decision on the project, she has no intention to stop those towers. She will, you know, at best use this process to extract some crumbs from the developer. So that ultimately will not stop the towers. But our case argued that the city should make a finding, which would definitely show that the towers will violate the zoning resolution, the requirement that any new development should not negatively interfere with the surrounding neighborhood. The towers of such scale definitely not meet that requirement. So the city, by doing the finding, pretty much admit that they will not approve the towers. So they would not be able to give the approval to the towers, you know, with the finding. So our argument politically is to say, you don't want the towers, we want to stop the towers from coming up.
But how about the need for every community to make a sacrifice to bring in the money that's necessary to pay for all these progressive programs the mayor has been giving us?
The mayor has been using this kind of luxury development to push community out. He has no interest in trying to preserve and protect the community as a way to privatize the public housing, privatize NYCHA. The outcome of it will be that these residents will be pushed out. So by privatizing it, pretty much make it unaffordable for the majority of people. Eventually, they have to move out. Whatever, you know, promise you give is not for them. And for these luxury developments, too, by encouraging them from coming in, they will drive up the real estate tax and the rent, make it unaffordable for the community. So whatever promise, you know, he makes, it's fake. It's not really, like, really truly benefits the people. The results from Wednesday, I think it shows the strength of the community that when we come together to hold the city accountable, we can make some progress. This is not the end. It's a small victory, and we need to continue to mobilize more people, organize the communities to be prepared for any outcome.
Zixuan Ning is a Chinatown-based activist. And that's some of the news for Monday, June 10th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.